Let's begin with Mark 7 and the healing of the Syrophoenician woman. We didn't get to talk about either of the miracles. The healing of the Syrophoenician woman, which is verses 24 to 30. And then at the end of chapter 7, verses 31 to the end of the chapter 31 to 37, where he heals the deaf man. And this, you're told in Matthew that he heals the deaf, but you're just given this one sentence summary. And in Mark, you actually get an account of the healing itself. So this is something in Mark that's not in Matthew. First, let's look at the Syrophoenician woman's, and maybe it'd be good to just remind ourselves of some of the details. He went to the region of Tyre and Sidon. He entered into a house and would not have anyone know it, yet it could not be hidden. Immediately a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit heard of him, came and fell down at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said, "Let the children first be fed. It's not right to take the children's bread, throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yea, Lord, not even the dog, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." He said, "For this thing you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." She went home, found the child lying in bed, and the demon gone. When you read Cornelius Lapide, he's this Jesuit commentator from the 1600s, He says there's this kind of great moral lesson that you see about prayer in this account that you get of the Syrophoenician woman. And he identifies all these qualities that you see in the way that she comes to our Lord and asks him. That she prays with humility. You know, she says, you know, she doesn't say, "I'm not a dog." But she says, you know, even the dogs get the crumbs from the table. That she's willing to lower herself. She's willing to humble herself because she wants from her daughter. She greets him with a title, right? She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Where is this? You know, some of this, that's the problem. Some of this in Mark, some of this in Mark is a little different from the way it is in Matthew. In fact, let's look at Matthew real quick. The Canaanite woman, "Have mercy," in Matthew, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely possessed by a demon." So you get her quote. In Mark, it's summarized. You know, she asked him. But in Matthew, this is Matthew 15:21. If you want to check there. "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely possessed by a demon." So there's this reverence, you know, that she greets him by this title. And also sort of as Lapide puts it, a kind of a modesty. Because as you look at the quote in Matthew, "My daughter is severely possessed by a demon," she just tells him the problem. She doesn't say, "Do this or do that." She says, "Here's my problem." And she leaves it up, in a way, up to him to decide what he's going to do, or leaves it to be understood, right, what she wants to do. There's a kind of prudence that she has. Again, I think all of us, no matter how many times we hear that narrative, when he says it's not right to take from the children, give it to the dogs, that she has that quickness, the mental quickness to say, "Yeah, but even the dogs get scraps. Can I just get a scrap here?" You gotta say, that's quick, that's fast on your feet. You are under stress. Your daughter is in possession of an unclean spirit. You're going to this guy who has miraculous power, and yet you still have this self-possession to be able to turn his rejection of you into this remark. In Matthew, you're told that she supplicates on her knees. She humbles herself. And again, that the bodily position of prayer matters. That's something I think in the modern world that we've lost sense of. There's a wonderful observation in the Screwtape Letters, where early on, as this guy is sort of coming back to the practice of his faith, Screwtape advises Wormwood, who's kind of in charge of this guy, you know, you must remember what they constantly forget, that they are animals, and what they do with their bodies affects their souls. So if you are kneeling, you're putting yourself into a position where you're expressing humility. And I had a graduate tell me that when she first read that as a sophomore, she came from a family where they have the habit of prayer going to bed, but she had just gotten in this habit right around 14 or so that she said her night prayers under the covers. You know? So there she is. Oh my God, I'm hardly sorry, having affinity. Angel of God, my guardian dear, right? Snug as a bug in a rug. And after she read this thing from Lewis, she realized, you know what? I should be kneeling by my bedside if I'm going to be expressing sorrow for sin. I should be kneeling by my bedside if I'm expressing a guardian angel be with me and guard me during the night. And she said from that point on, from reading that in C.S. Lewis, she went back to, and there's just this, it's this thing with teenagers that because they're on their way to getting more mature, they tend to associate what they did as children with being childish. And there's a kind of maturation that you need to recognize that not all the things you did as a child are childish. There are these things that you're told to do that you should just keep doing. You know, it's not childish because you did it as a child. Like, flush. Please. Thank you. There are all those things you learned in kindergarten really will sustain you for years to come. So that you train your children when they say their night prayers to say them on their knees, you know, because you're putting yourself in a position of humility. You're expressing through your body what you're trying to communicate verbally. You know, that's something that you should, that in a way teenagers need to be reminded of. And quite frankly, some of us as adults need to be reminded of. We can get, you know, say our prayers in the easy chair, very comfortable. But your body is not really communicating what it is that you're trying to. You know, I don't know that it works very well for him, for them. It works better for you. But you know, would you take seriously the husband at the other end of the table with the newspaper? Yeah, honey, I love you. No, I love you. Right? And doesn't even look up from the newspaper. It doesn't matter what's going on in his heart. If it's coming from behind the open newspaper, that physically does not express what it is that the person, what the husband intends to express, if he intends to express it. Resignation. Again, that she in some way accepts that he might help, he might not, but, you know, in Matthew, there's this plea to kind of help her, but again, that she's going to accept what it is that he's going to do. And then finally, the fact that she kind of sticks with it, that she doesn't just quit, a kind of a confidence in prayer, and an ardor that she really has this love for her daughter. You know, you can have children that you feel as though they're sort of going astray, or they're wayward, or they actually are astray. They actually are wayward, and so you pray for them, and you pray with ardor because you worry for them. Imagine, you know, the distress of this woman who actually has a girl who's possessed by an unclean spirit. I mean, she's not just, Mom, I don't believe in God. Mom, the church is all wet. You know, Mom, I don't want to live that kind of life or follow those kind of rules. I mean, she has, her will is in the hold of a demonic being. Imagine, you know, the intensity of that mother as she's pleading with our Lord. And yet to have the kind of, again, confidence, zeal, ardor, love, that she would stick with it. Go ahead.
So, in our world today, we can't really relate to being possessed by an unclean spirit.
I don't know why.
That's not in our frame of reference. How would you put that in today's frame of reference? Today that we could associate with. I mean, that, we don't walk around talking about people being possessed by demons or unclean spirits. The devil is there. We know that, but you know. they obviously had a much clearer.
Well, so let me just say, let me say a couple things to that, and then Ms. Gaylor, a few. First, that's just a crying shame, because the demonic is just as real now as it ever was. And it's true that whenever you have a report of somebody being possessed, you're going to have them go through a full psych eval, and most of the time that's going to eliminate. But for some number of cases, for some small fraction of cases, you have behavior that is not explainable by any kind of psychological problem. But second, the essential thing that's going on there that I think can transcend that particular problem is that the devil has a hold of the will. And when we look at somebody who's heading off in a direction for which we're just distressed and anxious, their will is pointed in the wrong way. Something has a hold of their will. It could be a bad habit, a bad person in their lives. There is something that has a hold of them. And so what you're doing is praying that something will come along, that our Lord will work in that person's life to free that hold. So again, to use another work of C.S. Lewis's, in the Great Divorce, where you have this busload of damned souls who are visiting heaven, and if they want to stay, they may stay. And most of them don't want to stay. And according to George MacDonald, who's sort of the Beatrice, you know, the guide, the divine guide for Lewis as he's going through, what he tells him is all of these souls have one thing in common, that there's something they prefer to the happiness that God offers. There's something they prefer to true happiness. So it could be sensual love, it could be money, it could be status, but there's something they love more. So just as this woman is praying for this devil to be pulled loose from her daughter, I think for us, there's always someone in our lives that we know there's something holding on to them. It may not be an evil spirit, but there's some kind of excessive love or resentment or sense of injury or whatnot that they just won't let go. Years ago when I was at Boston College, this is one of many reasons why I don't like petitions being said aloud at church. Maybe you like that. I just have lots of experiences like this. You have somebody, oh, for my grandmother who died such and such a time. Oh, for my aunt who's ailing. And then this guy in the back. That, let us pray for that man who wronged me in Warsaw in 1958. That God will have mercy on his soul. Lord, hear our prayer. You almost don't know what to do with that. You know, here's this guy who's holding on to something for what, 30, 40 years? And airing it out in church for all of us to hear. That guy needs healing. Something has a hold of him that won't let go. Mrs. Kaler, you had...
I was thinking, when you were talking about earlier, before Mary asked that question, I was thinking about all these, the kids that my girls know in a completely secular world, that they're completely secular schools, and my son probably knows, but like, he's just not doing because he's a boy, but girls talk about the girls and tell me about the girls that struggle in ways I don't even know what to tell them. Just be nice, you know, but struggling with trying to kill themselves with bulimia and anorexia,
yep.
The cutting.
Cutting.
Cutting is this huge thing. The girls that are in and out of different hospitalizations for different things, but it's all dealt with in a completely secular world, and where they go for treatment is completely secular. And who's not to say they're not completely possessed? And why are they possessed? I think just complete emptiness.
Yes.
Because all that the schools and the parents throw at them is more, here, have this, have this, have this, try this, try this, try this. It's all secular. And, you know, who knows?
I don't want to deny that usually where there's some kind of demonic involvement, what you look for is some kind of openness to the occult in some way. So, for example, in the book The Exorcist, remember Reagan gets possessed fooling around with a Ouija board. In the actual possession that book is based on, it was a little boy, it wasn't a little girl, and the boy's grandmother was into spiritualism. You know, this thing at the turn of the century, Uncle Cuthbert, if you're there, knock twice, you know, that sort of thing. And table turning. And the boy tried to get, his grandmother died, and then boy tried to get in touch with grandma, and a spirit showed up claiming to be grandma, and it wasn't grandma. Now, what I think, what we see in a lot of college kids is, college is not only, I mean, even when we all went to college, college is a very artificial world. There's something very artificial about reading books and having tests and living all together in a dorm all the time. Can you imagine like living like that again? I mean, there's something very artificial about that. But now, when you and I went to college, generally there was kind of more rules governing student life. And if you had to be naughty, you kind of had to move away from the campus a bit, or you had to find some area of naughtiness. It was harder to be naughty on campus. I guess it depends where you went to college too, though. But if you read a book like Tom Wolfe's I Am Charlotte Simmons, which is a composite of several colleges that Tom Wolfe visited and then wove together into a narrative, I read that and I don't recognize my own college experience. It's so extreme in terms of what college students have to deal with. The complete lack of any kind of privacy at all. The simple mainstreaming of sexual activity just sort of all the time on tap. Drugs have always been there, booze has always been there, but there are just fewer and fewer places which offer an alternative to that. So it's harder to find things that are outside the sort of entrenched either indulgence or like the things you're describing, psychologically stressed behavior that shows in things like cutting and bulimia and all those. It is the world that our college students are going into is just not the same. They're not going to your college. I mean, that's and unless you pick up a book like I Am Charlotte Simmons, which is very hard to read, you will not understand how different it is. You can't make it up. You can't make up co-ed bathrooms. You can't make up, you know, all of us at some level dealt with naughty sexual behavior in college. But, you know, were they bringing them back to your room? Were they having sex in your room? Were the people in your suite doing that? Were they doing that in the girls' dorm? Okay, now, maybe they were doing that when you were going to college, but probably that was more irregular, odd, it wasn't routine, it wasn't standard. And there are just a lot of things that are much more extreme, that are much more standard. I don't know if I would say those are kind of natural openings to the demonic, but I would say those are sort of natural openings to having not only moral decadence, but a feeling of despair that there's just no escape from it. And unless your young people are in a situation where there really is this vital campus ministry and, you know, like Focus or something like that, or Newman Centers, or there's something there for them, there's some sort of island and oasis and so on, I think that can just, for a lot of college students, just feel overwhelming. I think of one sweet Missouri Synod Lutheran girl that I know who goes to one of these private liberal arts schools, and one of the things that she really just enjoys about getting away from college is in her dorm, there are just all these sexually explicit or sexually suggestive pictures in the hallway in her dorm. And for her, it's not like titillating or arousing, it's just wearisome. It's just wearisome. And so to finally be able to get away from her dorm and be free of that, you know, that's the kind of a person, you don't worry about them being corrupted, you just worry about them being sort of exhausted. Yeah. Anyway, this is Air.
Yes, I just saw a movie this fall that blew me away, and I saw that accident. And this went on a Thursday night by myself. I thought I might try this. And they piloted a movie here in the Twin Cities that they did at Boston College. True story. You can look it up and research it. It's called The Dating Project. And the professor that did the movie, the professor that was part of in the movie, was all because she randomly happened to ask the question, how many are you dating now, or who's dating now, or whatever, and the whole class raised their hand in unison stating that nobody dates.
Yeah, nobody dates. And that was true at Boston College when I was there.
No dating.
Nope.
It's just hooking up.
Yep.
And you go out to drink, and you go have sex. And yep. That's what everybody does for the last 5 years. The way the movie ended was a little bit on an upbeat note, because they did take four different random boys and gave them a mission. They were to go out for 90 minutes, invite a girl, no phones were involved, they had to do this all in person, go on a date, and do this three different times and write a paper on it.
You see what I mean? This makes the point. I mean, you can't take your own experience and project it back and say, okay, college is going to be like that. You can't make this up. You can't invent. And a lot of times, college students don't come back and tell their parents this. They don't unload. Some children do, but most of them don't. So you got to find out yourself, because they're not going to.
They're not going to tell.
Yeah, they're not going. Yeah, go ahead.
An interesting note on the cutting and whatnot. A friend of mine whose children are here, and she's a child psychologist. We were talking about it a couple years ago, and she said normally what you would do in helping these children is you drill down the core beliefs. Who does God say you are? You know, essence, you would do that, or drill down to, you know, what are your morals and values? You're supposed to drill down to that. When they get down to finding the core of you are a good person and build from there,
right,
that helps the healing. She said the problem she sees with youth now is you drill down and there is nothing there.
There's nothing there.
There's nothing. They aren't raised with morals and the values and the belief in God. So she goes, where do you go? You have to now somehow create a foundation in a 16, 18, 22-year-old child that wasn't inherently there. And psychology would say that a morals and values in a child is in place by age 11. And so she said, we have this major conundrum in helping these kids that feel that emptiness, but because they weren't given the foundation of why morals and values, goodness, truth, and likeness of God, it is very hard to help these young adults.
Years ago when I taught at a Xavier, which is a black Catholic university, I remember reading something of St. Thomas's, it was St. Thomas saying, God's love is unequal, right? That obviously loves human beings, more he loves plants and animals, than even among human beings, right? That he chose the chosen people, and he gave them more than he gave other people, right? As he explains this. And I had this girl raise her hand and say, my mama told me that God loved everybody equally. What about that? Now, that is not something that would ever happen at Boston College. No white, wealthy, suburban girl is going to raise her hand. Well, my mother always explained to me that it's never going to happen. So think about what mom is for this middle-class black girl. My mother is a theological authority. My mother has, over time, given me proverbs, statements, little explanations, little narratives, and that's an authority for me. And just because now I'm in college and you got this fancy PhD at the front of the room and you've got St. Thomas Aquinas, does not mean I'm just going to drop it. You've got to give me a reason to now readjust what it is that I've grown up with. That girl is not someone you'd have to drill down to figure, like, who am I and what's my place? So as a Stanley Hauerwas put this so better than anybody I've ever read. He was a professor for a long time at Duke and then at Notre Dame, where he talked about, as an upper class or middle class American parent in the suburbs, you don't see your job as instructing your children. You abdicate that. So you take them to soccer lessons, and they train them in athletics, and you take them to dance, and they teach them to dance, and you take them to French, and they learn French, and you drop them off in this fancy school, and they learn the fancy school, and you take them to confirmation, and now the parish teaches them, or, you know, everybody else teaches them. You are the one person who's unqualified in the whole process. The only thing you have to offer is that, well, they're yours, and you got the money, so you put that together, and you take them to all of these people who are qualified to instruct them. So the way that he put it is, as an upper-class, educated American suburban parent, your job is not to teach your children. Your job is to oversee a process of enrichment that happens with all these eminently qualified people, of which you are not. Quickly, Karen.
I would also say that that this isn't just college anymore. I went to my daughter's, not here, but it's a public school, and the teacher was trying to convince me last night that genders don't exist.
Yep.
He's making them write a paper to that effect. And I was like, what? I just stood there like, you got me.
Dumbfounded, yep.
I was like, what? And this is an English class.
Of course it's an English class. What else would it be? Anyway, we got on this point because you look at of course these are, let's face it, these are the this is the thing that Mrs. Delmore is right to point out. I mean, these are the demons we're worried about. You know, we aren't anxious about demonic possession as such. We're anxious about all these other things that seem to be aiming at the souls of our children. You know, these are the things that we're praying about. These are the things that we're pleading with God to, you know, protect our children about. But again, I mean, the thing that I would want to emphasize from what, you know, Cornelia Salapide says here, you never want your anxiety to so overwhelm your confidence in God's love and overwhelm your prayer life. You know, she did not know how this was going to turn out, but she prayed with trust that he would respond in the way that it needed to be a response. By the way, one beautiful difference between Matthew and Mark, in Matthew you're told, real quick, in Matthew you're told at the end, woman, great is your faith, let it be done for you as you desire. Her daughter was healed instantly. But then when you go to Mark 7:30, she went home, found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. In other words, you don't just get she was healed, you get the picture. You know, Mark draws this lovely picture for you that, you know, imagine how that woman feels as she walks in and her daughter's no longer possessed, she's free, the demon is gone. He gives you the picture of it in a way that Matthew does not. Go ahead.
I do want to say in college, though, there is the other extreme, and that is every faith has a group at the colleges trying to get your kids. And it's a blessing, but it also it challenges the faith that they've been brought up in.
No, that's an excellent point. If that's why it is. If Catholic, if Catholic campus ministry offers something that's vital and devout and draws people into the sacramental richness of the faith, that's going to be attractive.
But it's
that's
also why people. Methodist,
no. But that's my point. But that's why someone like a Father Ron Ticelli at Boston College, you know, he's a kind of a Pied Piper. He's somebody he's not in his fancy suit. He's wearing his clerics that he gets kids to go to daily mass and adoration. This is Father Ron Ticelli, Father Ronald Ticelli. He's in the philosophy department at Boston College. And he's still there. He was there when I was there. He's there now. He's just a great... but he offers something that kids are attracted to. A lot of times, campus ministry by Catholics has been lame because it's been, wow, because it's sort of touchy-feely, it's soft, as be as you are. And a lot of these other faiths, they recognize if we're going to bring people in, we have to speak to a student's desire for holiness and nobility and, you know, and deal with the moral challenges that they know they're living through. They don't want a faith which just tells them, I'm okay, you're okay. And to the extent that you know, Catholics draw into that tradition and challenge students, they attract people. And to the extent that, for example, evangelical Christians offer a very clear faith with clear promises and clear challenges and the reality of sin and atonement, and the Catholics are sort of offering therapy, they're going to get walked all over. They're going to get walked all over. Yeah, go ahead.
As an alumni parent, my province daughter now is turning 30, and she went to Boston College, and it was because of Providence. Like, okay, parents can do only so much, but as far as the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts, I don't have that theology knowledge. And what she gained here gave her the armor And I tear up every time I say this because it gave her the armor to get through. And she loved her experience of the classes and all that, but the social thing was really a challenge.
Yes.
And she'll say it was this school that gave her the inner strength and the knowledge. Like, she knew in her heart of hearts that her Catholic faith was the right thing, and the morals and the right and wrong. And she was able to seek out a small group. And she, Father McNellis, I don't know if you know him.
I know his name, but I don't know Father McNellis.
College, and he has a group of, he has the Sons of St. Patrick for the boys, and then it's Grazia Plena for the girls.
For the girls.
And then they have a co-ed thing. And that she was able to seek that out. And it was like in a little teeny thing, and everything else was huge, even at a Catholic college.
Yeah.
And I was just with them last week in Chicago, and she met her husband, who was also a beautiful Catholic man, and at Boston College.
I love these stories that have happy endings.
Yeah, it is. And he said to me, and they have two kids now, and he said, if I didn't have my faith, I would be a puddle because of the challenges of the work life, married life, being a parent. I mean, it just, and the grace. And he went to a Catholic high school in Chicago, but it's the nuts and bolts that you guys give our kids, and in a way that resonates with them.
Now,
and it's
love being complimented. I'm going to carry this with me for the rest of the day. At the same time, though, we can only complete what parents are doing.
Right.
Whenever I get in front of a group of parents, like an open house or whatnot, I can't make your kids religious or faithful or devout.
Right.
I can't do that. I can only complete what you are doing.
It's a team effort.
Yes.
That's my point.
So that all this stuff that we do in the classroom, all these books, if they aren't going home to people who really buy into it in some very fundamental way, mm-hmm. nothing will happen.
Mm-hmm. And I remember a long time ago you said, people say, oh, you don't want to, you're just keeping your kid in a bubble if you send him to Providence. And I remember you said,
but what a bubble!
Right.
Own it! Yeah, own it!
Why not? Keep them in a bubble for as long as you can, because, man, once they get out in that college atmosphere, whoo! That bubble is gone forever.
Mr. Davis?
What is very sad is that I'd say a majority of Catholic schools today are probably contrary to what most parents that are faithfully Catholic want to see develop.
Yeah, alas. Yes. Alas. Let's talk about the healing of this deaf man. And maybe this will spark another whole thing about another whole set of worries that we have about our children. As I mentioned, I think a couple of weeks ago, remember there are these Aramaic moments in Mark that we don't get in the other Gospels. So when he works this miracle, ephephtha, right? Be opened. You know, so you're getting the actual words that our Lord is using in working these miracles. There's something lovely about that that happens in Mark and doesn't happen in the other ones. And for the Roman Catholic Church, for the Eastern Orthodox, and I looked it up in the 1928 Book of Common Prayer, so the Church of England, the old Anglican rites, in the rite of baptism, these are the words they use. They use, and in fact, in the baptismal rite in the Church of England, they use this reading as the preparatory reading, because the baby, before the baby's baptized, there's this blessing with oil of the baby, the baby's ears and mouth and so on. That's also true in the Eastern Orthodox rite in preparation for baptism. So this, and so it gives you a sense. Remember last week I was talking about the sort of radical Protestant position with regard to sacraments. When you look at what are called mainline Protestants, so you know, Lutherans and Methodists and so on, there's still a belief in sacraments and that sacraments are efficacious. So there's still going to be a belief in baptism. There's going to be a belief in Eucharist. There's confirmation is not going to be a sacrament. Marriage is not going to be a sacrament. But there's still going to be a belief in Eucharist and baptism. But once you get out to sort of the radical Reformed tradition or the, so Calvinist, the Presbyterian, sacraments are not, they are not signs which convey grace. They're signs which may be ordinances that remind you or call to mind, but they are not things that are vehicles of grace. And there tends to be in those communities this fear of using material things. It almost like feels pagan, like you have these sort of magical water and magical oils, and or isn't this a sort of a return to paganism in some way? But very clearly, when you look at the healing here at the end of chapter 7, and also when you look at the healing in chapter 8 at Bethsaida, he took the blind man by the hand, verse 23. He took the blind man by the hand, led him out of the village, and when he had spit on his eyes, laid hands upon him and asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up, "I see men, but they look like trees walking." Then again, he laid his hands on his eyes, looked intently and restored, and saw everything clearly. Jesus clearly means to give an example of God working through physical nature, working through material things to carry out his grace. He doesn't do that because he has to. He doesn't do that because somehow his divine power isn't enough. He does it for us. We are creatures that come to a knowledge of spiritual things through our senses, through what we see, what we taste, touch, feel. And in fact, that's the very reason behind the incarnation, that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, this invisible God who all these pagan nations are seeking in some way, but they keep seeking him in a visible way. They keep making idols and goats and golden calves and statues of the emperor and so on. They keep wanting there to be a physical God. Once the Hebrew people had enough theological development to finally break free of idolatry, right? Remember, when they come home from Babylon, after the Babylonian captivity, they are not idolatrous anymore. That's over. They are now able to be the vehicle for this infinite God, this spiritual God, taking on a human nature and becoming visible. Okay? So in a way, the sacraments continue what it is that Christ himself began by taking on a human body. We can't just come to a knowledge of spiritual things and spiritual realities without there being any kind of sensible thing there at all. We depend on that. I remember one year when I was teaching sacraments, this was here, and I had one student say, I don't understand why God has to use anything at all. Why can't he, I mean, if he wants us to all be baptized and all be clean from sin, why doesn't he just, right, you're all free from sin? And in a way, it was a profound question. It was like, why can't grace be like air in the atmosphere or electricity, or why can't you just like tap into it at any point? Why can't it be like the Wi-Fi? You know, got your hotspot, you tap into it, there it is. It's just available for you. I realized, in fact, the very next year after that, I realized I got to build up to this more. That's why you always have to let students talk as much as possible. I mean, not just blah, 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 but you, because you find out things like this. You are sitting there thinking, okay, I've got to talk about baptism and confirmation and what the grace is and form of the matter. And there's the kid telling you, I don't understand why it is that really there have to be determinate means for grace at all. No, that's a very instructive thing. So I took them all the way back to Exodus. And when the Jews are coming to the desert and they're coming to Mount Sinai, and God says to Moses, okay, I'm going to meet you on the mountain. I'm going to bring you up. The people are going to go so far, and then I'm going to blow my trumpet. They'll come up a little farther, and I want them to be ready. They're going to be 3 days. They're going to fast. They're going to purify themselves. They're going to abstain from relations with their wives and so on. And then There'll be a trumpet blast, and you will come up, and they will stay behind. Okay? Notice that if God is going to make himself present, you got to be ready. There's got to be this interior preparation. And there are going to be signs that he's there. There's going to be signs that he's there. In fact, when he actually shows up and there's thunder and lightning, right? You go talk to him, Moses. We don't want to talk to him. You go talk to him. So the thing that I don't know that I said as clearly as I should have, and I made sure from then on out to do was, you know, when you're talking about grace, you're talking about God being present. Being present in you, being present in your soul. But how do you know that for yourself? What is the way in which God is going to make this known to you? And even for yourself, how do you prepare yourself for it? How do you know that you're in a state in which now God is able to come into you and be with you and dwell with you? Okay? And so that's the idea. When you see these healings and you see God making use of the mud or of the water or whatnot, he's giving you sensible signs of what he's up to spiritually. Okay? By the way, isn't it kind of neat that it's like the miracle doesn't sort of work right away? You know, you would think, this is God. Doesn't he give like the right dosage the first time? But no, he puts it on. Okay, how's that? People look like walking trees. Okay, a little more, a little more. How's that? And of course, when someone like a St. Augustine will comment on that passage, he'll remark, this is showing you that there are ways in which grace can work instantaneously, but there are also ways in which grace works gradually. So chances are, if you think about your own embrace of the faith or moments of deepening in the faith, probably it was not something where it was just, boom, right? I meant to do this, or I should do this, or I should embrace that. There was something that you saw first, and you kind of moved along that, and then it said, oh, wait a minute, I really need to be doing this, right? And then it came more fully. So grace is not something that, even though it's miraculous, it's supernatural power, it's something that God proportions to you, gives you a bit at a time. And it's as if there are points where what we're able or ready to see is people who are like walking around like trees. In other words, we're seeing something, but we're seeing it incompletely or fuzzily. But that is a stage to now the next dose, where we'll be able to see or understand it fully. See or understand it fully. So, well, we made it to a little bit of chapter 8. So next time, none of your problems. Don't stop worrying about your children. Stop worrying about all these things going on in your life, okay? We're just gonna get through this book and not worry about whether it applies to our life or not, okay? So is it next time that we're off? Okay, so next week, no Bible study, week after, and then it'll be Thanksgiving. And so that one's off too. Very good. See you next time.